Pro tip. Don't overcomplicate things. One potential pitfall to the sort of intellectual exploration we're encouraging is that you may be tempted to try all sorts of different practices. This book is focused on mindfulness meditation, but there are scores of other flavors, from Zen to Tibetan to Vedic and beyond. At least at the beginning, our advice is to pick one path and stick with it. As Jeff said to the crowd at Wanderlust, if you're doing multiple practices at the same time, how are you going to know what works for you? Bill Duane agrees. He said, I would caution against getting too crazy with the mix and match. He believes it's best to fully explore one tradition before branching out too widely. Here's Jeff now with some advice on how to combine the practices described in this book in order to create an abiding habit.
A practice built to last. The foundational meditation in this book is Chapter 2's Concentration 101. It's nice to have a home-based practice with a home-based focus that you don't have to think about. You just do. My advice is that you make Concentration 101 your go-to, with some relatively consistent sensation that you like working with. Breath, belly, heart, sound, body. As you do this, you're clear that you're building your basic skills, and you know what those skills are. Mindfulness, concentration, clarity, equanimity, friendliness, and enjoyment as a sexy bonus. You do your best to be relaxed and easygoing and curious about your experience. This, too, is part of the training. And since you're human like everybody else, some days it'll be easy, other days it will be hard. Mind wanders, bring it back. Every moment's a new beginning. It's a new beginning because it's not about building up to some special experience. All experiences come and go. It's about the training underneath all this, our growing ability to notice and be with whatever's happening. This is literally all you need to do and to know. Time and nature will do the rest. If you want to thread in some investigatory insight work, then anytime you get pulled into a distraction, be curious about the distraction, as per chapters 4 and 6. Name it, note it, spend a couple minutes exploring its location and form and contour and triggers. The more curious you can get about these strangely familiar patterns, the less you'll be fated to repeat them. Explore, and then go back to your main object. If doing this throws you hopelessly off course, then don't do it. Stick to the breath. Just this will still build up the basic qualities of attention. I like to finish my sit with a compassion or a loving-kindness practice to build up this muscle explicitly. I also do a version of what some call the dedication of merit, in which I imagine the good generated by the practice, and then I imagine giving it away to various rich celebrities and CEOs. Just kidding. I imagine giving it to whoever needs it. Then I sit for a bit and do nothing, resting, letting everything integrate. Right there is a solid sequence that you can use as your default. It can easily last you a lifetime and give you plenty of insight and peace. But you also have these other tools that you may want to check in with as opportunity and interest arise. So if you're cruising around town, there are many endlessly customizable free-range options for listening, looking, feeling, touching, Chapter 3, to say nothing of running, Chapter 8, and walking, also Chapter 8. If you feel ruinously ass-kicked by life and want a break, then crash out on the floor and do a Taking Back Lazy, Chapter 5, or Self-Compassion Practice, Chapter 5 again. If someone's standing in front of you in pain, then implement a compassion practice, also Chapter 5, which is as much about steady presence as it is about warmth and concern. And finally, if you find yourself inside some emotional challenge, then one option is to decide to face and explore your feelings, always with a desire not to change them, but to know and understand and honor them. Chapter 6. Through all of these practices, through life itself, there's one constant to always come back to, mindfulness. What's actually happening right now? Thinking, feeling, seeing, hearing. I know these things are happening. This is the ultimate habit to build, the ultimate training, one you can come back to every moment of the day. The more you do this, the more you deliberately live inside this awareness, the more that awareness expands. Awareness itself gets more open, more roomy.
Pro tip, just put your body there. Even on days when you really don't feel like meditating, try to see if you can wrangle yourself onto your cushion or chair or wherever you sit, even if only for a few seconds. Often just being in the posture will lead to a few minutes of practice. As the brilliant meditation teacher Sharon Salzberg was advised by one of her teachers during the rocky early days of her practice, just put your body there. Don't think about what is going to happen or how long it's going to last. Just get yourself there. Per Jeff, one thing that can make this process easier is having a regular spot in your home to meditate. As he says, all the associations with meditation pile up. As soon as you sit down, the various contextual cues help the habit take over. Pro tip, use meditation as a prophylactic. Back at our event at Newton South High School earlier in the road trip, we heard from a woman named Rebecca who explained that she was prone to depression and anxiety, both of which were inflamed when she encountered difficult life events, such as, in her words, a sick parent or a medical issue or a job that sucks. Of late, she said, her circumstances had been quite smooth, which had prompted her to cut back on her practice. It's like, I'm calm, I feel good, I don't need to meditate. If you're only meditating to deal with acute situations, you are setting yourself up for streakiness. I approach meditation the way I approach working out. As I said to Rebecca, I don't just exercise when I'm feeling overweight, I do it to prevent feeling overweight. The vicissitudes of life are always going to reemerge. You should be prepared to handle them as best as possible. Meditation, in my experience, is best used as a prophylactic rather than as first aid. Pro tip, take it easy with the practice assessment tapes. At Wanderlust, we heard from an older gentleman with salt and pepper hair who told us that after decades of flirting with meditation, he had finally established a daily habit. For the past year, he said, he had been sitting 20 minutes a day. Now, however, he was encountering new issues, doubt and disappointment in his meditative abilities. He said he was still getting distracted frequently. I'm disappointed in myself that after a year, I don't feel like I've progressed. My kind of guy. I have spent an inordinate amount of time gnashing my teeth over what an awful meditator I am. There is one thing I have learned as a result of all of this angst. It is a gigantic waste of time. Expectations, I said to my new friend, are the most noxious ingredient you can add to the meditation stew. Straight back to the time of the Buddha, desire has been considered to be a hindrance. Maddeningly and paradoxically, it blocks you from the very concentration and mindfulness you're hoping to achieve. This is why meditation is such a counterintuitive pursuit for type A Westerners. Ambition and striving, the assets that often help us so much in the rest of our lives, can work against us on the cushion. The following quote from scientist come meditation teacher Jon Kabat-Zinn is one of the most valuable things I've heard anyone say about the practice. Meditation is not about feeling a certain way. It's about feeling the way you feel. If you're expecting meditation to be a bubble bath or a blissful, laser-focused escape from your relentless inner news crawl, you are likely setting yourself up for disappointment. The goal is to be open to whatever comes up and to approach it all with mindfulness, friendliness, and interest. If you find yourself encountering a murderer's row of boredom, restlessness, and physical discomfort, so be it. Your only job is to try to see it all clearly, and then when you get caught up, to start again. In fact, a quote-unquote bad sit can often be where you grow the most, like a particularly vigorous workout, because you are learning how to relate to difficulty. After all, equanimity, as Jeff has told us over and over, is one of the key mental muscles you're trying to build here. It helps to have faith, or if you prefer, confidence, that even when you feel like you're totally wasting your time, you're not. As Bob Roth, a prominent teacher of transcendental meditation, has said, even in a shallow dive, we get wet. There are two little tricks that I have found useful when I find myself playing and replaying what my teacher Joseph Goldstein calls the practice assessment tapes. First, when you catch yourself worrying about the state of your contemplative career, try making a soft mental note of doubt. For me, that often unties the knot, at least temporarily. Oh yeah, all this crazy thinking is just the mental state of doubt. The second hack is called an attitude check. Every once in a while, during meditation, maybe ask yourself, what's the attitude in my mind right now? Am I wanting something to be different? This can smoke out subconscious striving or aversion, which then often dissipates. I'm not arguing that you should never inquire about the state of your practice. This is where talking to a teacher can be especially helpful, because that person can point out if you're stuck in some sort of rut. But obsessing about it all the time is almost certainly not constructive. For myself, I've found that slowly but surely, my ability to concentrate has improved over time. However, progress is uneven, and backsliding, perceived or real, happens frequently. Even though I often endure bouts of doubt, I have generated a certain level of trust that this meditation thing really does work. All you have to do is look at the MRI scans of longtime meditators. Their brains are different. The trick is just to do the practice and then, as Jeff likes to say, let time and nature do their thing. Joseph Goldstein tells the story of how when he was a kid, his parents helped him plant a garden, but Joseph, impatient, kept pulling up the carrots to see how they were growing. Time and nature. One additional note on the practice assessment tapes. The best measure of your meditation skills is not the quality of your last sit, but instead the quality of your actual life. How are your relationships? Are you a better listener? Are you losing your temper less frequently? In short, are you less of a jerk? As Sharon Salzberg has said, we don't meditate to get better at meditating. We meditate to get better at life. Obviously, the practice won't erase your fallibility or flaws. I hope Jeff and I have amply illustrated how illusory the notion of perfection is. Don't write yourself off as a failure if you're still popping off in anger once in a while. I still get captured by my emotions, but I find that I catch myself earlier and apologize more speedily. Also, pay attention to what my friend Sam Harris, no relation, a writer and neuroscientist, has called the half-life of anger. For me, I found that my anger is much shorter lived and also less intense these days. As Sam says, the difference between the amount of damage you can do in 2 minutes of anger and what you can do in 2 hours is incalculable. And that leads to the final piece of advice. Pro tip. Tune into the benefits. In many ways, we are all like rats in a maze, constantly pressing the levers that deliver food pellets to us. Behavior change science strongly suggests that the best way to ensure a consistent meditation habit is to identify where and how the practice is giving you pellets. Just like rats, we're much more likely to keep doing something if it feels good and we get something out of it. There are at least two levels to this. The first level, as we've previously discussed, is to pay attention to how the act of meditating in itself can be pleasurable. As Jeff told the man at Wanderlust who was worried about the progress of his practice, it's nice to have goals, but also, in Jeff's words, you want to be enjoying yourself in the practice. Notice how good it feels to step out of the traffic and get quiet, said Jeff. Tune into your juicy animal body. That last Jeffism, juicy animal body, made me wince a little bit, but hey, we were in L.A. and it was the last night of the tour. The other level is to notice the benefits as they arise in the rest of your life, in terms of both inner weather and outer comportment. Bill Duane told the crowd that a year after taking an in-house meditation course, Google employees reported a 23% decrease in emotional reactivity and a 19% increase in the ability to manage workplace stress. One of the best ways to see the benefit of meditation is to feel its absence when you fall off the wagon. We heard this from many people throughout the road trip. For instance, Elvis Duran, the radio host, said when he neglected meditation, the days are usually more stressful. Personally, I noticed that when I've been forced by circumstances to reduce my meditation quotient, my inner toxicity skyrockets. And here's a rich irony. While focusing on the pellets you get from meditation can help create consistency, the more you do the practice, the less driven you may be by pellet seeking generally. You might find a new kind of happiness. While humans have been bred over millennia to chase the pleasant, run from the unpleasant, and zone out in the face of neutral stimuli, meditation, as we've discussed, provides an alternative, the ability to engage with it all fully. This skill allows you, however briefly, to step off the treadmill of getting and doing. Many of us assume that we will finally be happy and complete when all of our wishes are fulfilled, when we hit the lottery, master the stanky leg, or get more likes on our Instagram posts. It's the primordial lie we are constantly telling and retelling ourselves. But this is to confuse happiness with excitement. All of which inexorably leads to another question. What is happiness anyway? For years, I asked tons of smart people about this, and I never got a truly satisfying answer. Then one night over dinner, I put the question to my friend Dr. Mark Epstein, a psychiatrist, author, and meditator. He said, more of the good stuff and less of the bad. Initially, I was unmoved. Over time, though, I began to see the wisdom of this modest assertion. After years of meditation, I found that the good stuff in my life has gotten better and more sustained because I'm spending more time enjoying the positive developments rather than rushing on to the next thing. And the bad stuff in my life has become less intolerable and less sustained because I'm less lost in useless rumination over my perceived misfortune. And the cool part is that, unlike physical exercise, this kind of mental training is not limited by the laws of physics. If you can get 10% happier, what's the ceiling? Okay, so we've thrown a ton of tips at you in this chapter. Please don't let the sheer volume allow you to fall into the biggest and most common trap of all, not getting started. Here's a quick brass tacks summary. 1. Approach the establishing of a meditation habit as an experiment. You're not making a lifetime commitment here. 2. Be willing to fail. Know that failure is part of the process. 3. Start small. Don't take on too much too soon. 1 minute counts. 4. Try attaching meditation to a pre-existing habit. For example, after I shower or run or have my morning coffee, I meditate for a minute. And finally, 5. Stay on the lookout for the life benefits. Let them pull you forward. Good luck out there. Back at Wanderlust, as we entered the final hour of our final event of the road trip, we called Moby up to the stage. I explained that I had known Moby off and on for more than a decade, back from when we were both younger, more social guys in New York City. He looked pretty much the same after all these years, wearing a khaki military jacket with a hoodie underneath. He had a trim, graying beard and was lean from his vegan diet and alcohol-free lifestyle. Even after the platinum records and world tours, he still carried himself with the outsider intensity of a kid who grew up poor in a wealthy town in Connecticut. Despite knowing Moby for some time, I had just recently learned that not only was he a meditator, but he was also, in his words, a secret meditation teacher. He had first practiced as a little kid because his single mom, who he called a spiritual dilettante, would have him do it. As a grown-up, he learned transcendental meditation from fellow celebrity David Lynch and then later explored various forms of Buddhist meditation. Moby's a famously shy person, but he was in fine form on this night, dropping F-bombs alongside some real wisdom as he spoke from personal experience about the often illusory links between success and happiness. He said, "The people who've had the most material success, I grew up with these people. They're so unhappy. We assume that it's going to create some happiness that's not available to us right now. I thought, if I have the right career, the right girlfriend, the right other girlfriend, the right other girlfriend, the right combination of alcohol, drugs, fame, public notoriety, money, etc., etc., then I'll be happy. But then the universe gave all that to me, and I was miserable. In response to all the people in the crowd who had voiced doubts about their own meditation, Moby argued that we should not fall prey to similar assumptions. He said, "Don't use meditation as an opportunity to be critical of yourself, because no one is doing it better than you are." He told us that he had tortured himself in this way for years. "It's like I'm convinced I'm not doing it right, and I'm not doing it enough, and if only I did the right meditation practice, then I'll finally find enlightenment." He said he had come to the conclusion that enlightenment is not some magical transcendence. Enlightenment, I believe, is right where you are right now. It's just having a different relationship to it that's based on kindness and acceptance. I have spent an enormous amount of time trying to figure out whether I believe in enlightenment, but if there is indeed such a thing, Moby's definition sounds about right to me. Then it was time to meditate. After weeks of to-ing and fro-ing over email about whether Moby was going to lead a musical meditation, and despite actually bringing a music track with him, he decided on the spot to ditch it and go in an entirely different direction. For the first part, he announced, "We're going to do some very simple chanting." Oh, dear Lord, I thought, please, no, no, no. It turned out to be fine. Better than fine, even. Poetic. After 11 days of trying to tamp down on the weirdness factor, here I was in a situation beyond my control, chanting in Sanskrit with Moby and a few hundred strangers. Jeff was kicking my leg and trying to stifle his laughter. The only regret I had was that this situation was maybe a little unfair to my man Jeff. After all the time spent relentlessly hazing him into repressing his tendency toward esoterica, here was Moby closing out our road trip with a long and lusty round of chanting. So now that we're nearing the end of this book, I think Jeff deserves his shot to get as mystical as he wants about what meditation can do for us. Okay, my friend, go for it.
Okay, let's talk about where meditation and mindfulness practice ultimately lead. Imagine, if you will, one of those 13th century Scottish fight scenes with Mel Gibson. The untrained and distracted mind is a melee of broadswords and hideous grimaces, war cries, people's heads flying off. As we practice returning to the breath, we slowly build up the necessary stability in awareness to notice this battle that we've been waging with ourselves. We recognize, we accept, we remember. Very slowly, the internal thugs get disarmed. Eventually, they're gathered in a circle, drinking mead and hiccuping and singing weepy Gaelic ballads. A great calm descends upon the land. So that's one part of it. The other is we start to notice and appreciate the gorgeous green highland scenery that these idiots have been standing in front of the whole time.
So you're saying the practice leads to a keener awareness of what's always been there?
Kind of like what Moby said. It's being right where you are, only now you're noticing it in a new way. But for this to happen, it does help to take care of the Mel Gibson problem.
But none of that seems particularly far out. It seems like common sense.
The mystical piece has to do with the open landscape, because it isn't just that you have a new capacity to notice and appreciate the sights and sounds and smells of the world, although this part is more than enough reward for your efforts. It's also that the world itself gets increasingly permeated with something else, something more, an extra sparkle and mystery that you start to realize has always been there. So life still has its ups and downs. Even for long-term practitioners, they get sick, they lose their jobs and loved ones, and they deal with hardship just like everyone. But many of them also report something else. Their baseline level of happiness and fulfillment just keeps increasing. What's actually happening is that that baseline is no longer entirely determined by those ups and downs. It's as though a third dimension has entered into experience, a depth dimension. One that extends out beyond our circumstances and conditions, a kind of invisible breadth and volume.
So just for anybody who's confused, including me, what do you actually mean by that, the depth?
That's the mystery, and that's always been the mystery. No one has ever been able to really say. It doesn't seem to be particularly amenable to language and concepts. Over the years, mystics and meditators have struggled to come up with a language to describe this ineffable thing. So we get these jargony spiritual terms like being, or oneness, or awareness, or God, or the moment, or even emptiness.
Some of this jargon is frustrating. I understand, though, that people are trying to talk about things that are basically impossible to describe. But I suppose some people might say, well, when people use terms like being or oneness or all the words that you just used, is that just another way to talk about happiness?
The point I'm trying to make is that it isn't happiness. Happiness is secondary. Happiness and fulfillment are the human responses to deepening in this way. And not the only responses. All the other human goodies roll out from here, too. So more gratitude, more humility, more equanimity, more peace, more meaning, more connectedness, more poignancy, more love, more Wunderstorchladen, to quote a German word I just made up that means, roughly, miracle-constructed cow patty.
Holy scheiße.
These qualities tend to increase, but they also come and go, as all effects and experiences come and go. What I'm talking about is more the space these qualities can spread into. It stabilizes people. It gives them purchase in more and more of life. And, as contemplatives have said again and again, it has more to do with how we are than what we do. And that's what our last meditation is about. The pure practice of, yes, enjoying your beingness. Dan's mockery ends here. This shift to enjoying your beingness is hard to describe, and yet nothing is more important. We all exist, so we may as well notice and enjoy it. In this sense, it's the ultimate training. Call it a do-nothing meditation. The idea is to try not to control things in any way. To sit like a samurai inside your experience with the attitude that nothing needs to be any different. The moment is perfect and complete. So you don't need to intentionally notice the breath or intentionally get concentrated or deliberately pay attention to anything. You just sit and try to be okay with that.
Yeah, but I struggled with this during the taking back lazy meditation a little while back. When you tell me to do nothing, it stresses me out. I like having a clear technique.
And that's fine. It's actually normal, especially for type A people. We're all in a panic to do, to get shit done, to check items off our existential to-do lists. This practice is about seeing if we can reverse that momentum a little bit. Actually and truly relax, which is extremely hard to do when all you know is go.
Okay, I'll try.
If this particular meditation doesn't ultimately appeal, no big deal. But it's worth exploring at least once, particularly since some people love it. They're grateful for the opportunity to not have to do anything for once. So let's see what happens. We'll start with a basic concentration practice, and then we'll move into the do-nothing piece to get a contrast. The reader can just go through this and try it afterwards. I'll give you the two-word cheat sheet summary right now. Do nothing. Do nothing. A meditation. 5 minutes or longer. So we start in the usual way. Close your eyes if that's your go-to, take in a few deep breaths, set your attitude here, open, easygoing, just exploring, nothing to get uptight about. We're sitting with our eyes closed, getting ready to do nothing. It's hard to imagine the stakes being any lower. Like I said, it can be nice to get a bit of a contrast, so for the first few minutes of this meditation, start by seeing how deliberately concentrated you can get. This is not yet doing nothing. We're doing something, working up to nothing. So choose an object, breath, belly, hands, bum, sounds, and try as best you can to hold that direction. See if you can find a little enjoyment in the opportunity to do just one thing, to feel, to breathe, to listen. Nothing else you need to do. So it's definitely simplifying. You can note in and out, or feel, or sound, or whatever helps you get focused. Mind wanders, deliberately bring it back. As you get into the meditation, your breathing may start to slow naturally. See how still you can get. The stiller you are, the subtler and deeper you may go. The process is very delicate. How smoothly can you experience this sensation, this sound? Can you feel it as a single, continuous, and enjoyable thing? The idea is to get as concentrated as you can here, but, as always, to enjoy the process. Okay, so now we make our big shift. For the remainder of the meditation, drop all noting, drop all attempts to deliberately focus on anything, and just do nothing. Let go. The idea is to stop trying to control your experience in any way, and to let your attention just spontaneously be pulled where it gets pulled, settling where it settles. It may feel weird at first, but try to surrender to it. You're saying yes to everything. See what happens.
Okay, so I have a report. I got concentrated on my breath like you instructed, and then I moved into the do nothing, and almost immediately it was like my mind got thrown into a blender of neurotic thinking. And of course, when I notice I'm thinking, I want to revert back to what you taught us earlier in the book and make a note, a mental note, thinking. But then I remember that I'm not supposed to do anything. So I want to grab you by the metaphorical lapels and beg you for an actual instruction.
And the instruction is to do nothing. Let the thinking happen. Either it'll play itself out or it won't. Both are completely fine. Noting's also fine if it happens automatically. I know it's a bit confusing, but you don't actually have to prevent your mind from implementing any habitual meditation technique. If it's really a habit, then by definition, it's not in your control, and trying to stop it would be a doing. So the instruction is to let whatever happens happen without striving or adding anything. Just completely back off and let the whole ball of yarn unspool on its own. If that means you get all spaced out or end up helplessly replaying the stupidest conversation you've ever had with yourself, then so be it.
Yeah, but it's incredibly frustrating.
That's because it's all you know, bro. It's okay. In a really gentle way, we're working to unclench the part of your brain that thinks it needs to endlessly negotiate with reality, to make all these adjustments, to prove yourself and improve yourself, to earn your keep, to get it right. But you don't have to get anything right here, or prove yourself to anyone. It's okay. You're right where you need to be, and you're 100% allowed to be here. Remember, equanimity is also acceptance and trust and forgiveness. So forgive yourself for not being perfect at this and see what happens.
Okay.
You okay, bud?
Yeah. Actually, something sort of clicked when you said that. I stopped caring that thinking was happening and things started to get peaceful and drifty. Every time I noticed I was distracted, instead of getting pissed at myself, I realized I wasn't breaking any rules. I went from feeling angry at you for refusing to give me something to do to feeling a lot of gratitude.
That's good. Keep going. When we loosen up, we make room for new things to make their visit. This is about trusting we'll be okay. It's not easy. This is the end of effort. No more striving, no more work. You can rest here. No longer meditating at all. Let nature meditate you. When you're ready, open your eyes.
I gather my hands together and bow to the still point, the center, where nothing needs to happen.
Oy, Daniel.
Epilogue. There was a nice little afterglow before everything went pear-shaped. In the first few weeks after I got home from the road trip, I embraced with increasing robustness some of Jeff's primary teachings, including moves I had previously written off as too embarrassing to even consider. I was beginning every sit with a commitment to not being uptight. I was attempting to enjoy my juicy animal body. And, of course, I was continuously endeavoring to up my welcome to the party game. It was becoming ever more clear to me, not intellectually, but experientially, that when I extended hospitality to my distractions and obsessions rather than fighting with them, it conserved a lot of otherwise wasted energy and helped my meditation to flow more smoothly. I even caved and started naming my various inner voices. When Jeff initially told me how he gave his competing neurotic programs friendly nicknames such as El Grandioso, I thought it was amusing, but too cute for me to pull off personally. However, the more I welcomed all of my mental mishigas to the proverbial party, the more playful my attitude became toward the internal dramatis personae. Plus, as Jeff often said, no one else is there to see what you're doing in the privacy of your own mind during meditation, so why bother getting self-conscious? The easiest voice to identify was, unsurprisingly, Robert Johnson. Whenever I felt a surge of anger, resentment, or paranoia, I would give him a cordial greeting. Bobby J., you old so-and-so, welcome to the party. Then there was the inner hustler, constantly plotting, scheming, and worrying about my career. I decided to name him Sammy after the backstabbing, rabidly ambitious Hollywood climber from the novel What Makes Sammy Run. I would salute him with a big blast of cheesy air horn like a DJ at a bad nightclub in New Jersey. I made up names for my anxious inner planner, Julie the cruise director, and also for the voice that was always working on writing this book, Arthur, which for some reason I decided was easier to mentally pronounce than author. Finally, I had to come up with a name for the voice that was always popping up to spout nonsense. I opted for Randy, short for random, and also, serendipitously, the name of the obnoxious comic played by Aziz Ansari in the movie Funny People. He would show up in my meditations, usually in the following manner. In. Out. Want to hear some of my favorite taglines? From the trailer for the 1980s B-movie Hard Bodies, if you see only one movie this summer, see this one also. From a pamphlet spotted in the Colby College Health Center in 1993, chlamydia is not a flower. Okay, Randy, welcome to the party. In. Out. Reminder, ask the ABC News polling people to investigate my theory that there's a statistical correlation between people who like cats and people who prefer vanilla ice cream, and likewise for dogs and chocolate. Remember that store that used to be on Main Street in Waterville, Maine, called Strictly Pets and Birds? Were they trying to say that birds aren't pets? And if so, how could it have been Strictly Pets? Are you fucking kidding? I mean, welcome to the party, Randy. It was not uncommon for the welcoming words to be unaccompanied by the intended sentiment. As I delved more deeply into this practice, I saw that there was often an underlying attitude in my mind that these quote-unquote interruptions should not be happening. When I could sense the misty black tendrils of Johnsonian fury curling around the edges of the good cheer I was attempting to extend, I would make a double note, Randy with a side dish of RJ. I persevered, though, keeping in mind Jeff's helpful advice that you could fake it until you make it. Sure enough, gradually but steadily, I began genuinely generating increasing amounts of goodwill for my inner Greek chorus. I could acknowledge what Jeff had pointed out on the bus, lo these many weeks ago, that many of these voices, the angermonger, the logistician, the strategist, were actually trying to help me, even if they were a little overzealous. When I would notice myself getting carried away by one of these characters, I would invite him or her in and investigate with the help of the RAIN tool that Jeff taught us earlier. Where does worry show up in the body? Is my jaw tight? My stomach roiled? More often than not, that openness and interest would defang the visitor, even if he or she reemerged nanoseconds later. It wasn't foolproof, but the overall effect was unmistakable. The punitive vibe was improving. Sometimes I would catch myself actually smiling when I noticed that one of my inner rascals had come along and commandeered my mindfulness. If this wasn't an example of Jeff's concept of friendliness, what was? At other times, I was able to muster unaffected self-compassion. One day when I had a cold and kept falling asleep during meditation, instead of greeting the bouts of fatigue with self-recrimination, I found myself saying, "You're sick, dude. No worries." Another day, I noticed that I had spent the first few minutes of the sit preoccupied by concern over some health issues my dad was having. After an initial lurch toward criticizing myself for being distracted, I realized that the worrying about my father was a voice I had not perceived very clearly before. Nice, Dan. I got the warm and fuzzies for him. That guy deserves more airtime. It was humbling to realize that it had taken 8 years of meditating to start following my own advice about seeing the moment of waking up from distraction as a victory, but at least it was nice to be less of a hypocrite. This interior liberality allowed me to relax somewhat in the face of a gigantic challenge, writing this book on an absurdly tight deadline. We finished the road trip in February, and the manuscript was due in early June. That set up a punishing schedule. We divided the labor. While I worked on a chapter, Carly, a.k.a. Rage Fairy, although for the record, I've never seen her in anything other than a sunny mood, would comb through the hours and hours of transcripts from our many shoots, creating an outline for me to use for the next chapter. Jeff, meanwhile, was busy writing and inserting all the meditation instructions. As soon as one of us finished our work, we would share it on Google Docs, and everyone would jump in and make their notes, which would show up along the digital margins of the page. The commentary was filled with cheerleading, brainstorming, and spirited debate. Generally speaking, I have a love-hate relationship with writing, and it's about 98% hate. It took me 4 years to write my first book, and the process was characterized by rampant self-doubt, frustration, and fear. As the old cliche goes, no one likes writing, they like having written. However, the writing experience this time was markedly different, in part because of the camaraderie. It was fun to be involved in a group effort with such smart partners, which was similar to the way we work in TV news. The process was also ameliorated by the fact that I was employing techniques I had learned from Jeff. When I would find myself spinning off into hand-wringing over how I was going to get all of my work done and whether it was going to stink in the end, I would try to reconnect to my core intention, which was to further our collective aim of helping people meditate. Motivation, in my view, runs along a spectrum. It's natural to have financial and self-promotional goals, but when you can mindfully tune in to the desire to benefit others, it can make the whole endeavor more buoyant. Mindfulness was also useful during the writing process when I would bump up against the racking pain of a seemingly insoluble stylistic or structural problem. Instead of getting all tight and constricted, I would remember what I had learned about the science of creativity. Work hard, study your material diligently, and then let it go. The answer may come later when you're relaxed. This is why people talk about having epiphanies in the shower. This time, when I hit a roadblock, instead of trying to bulldoze my way through it, I would meditate, just sitting with the discomfort of unknowing. Often, these meditations would produce geysers of ideas, even if they weren't necessarily the ideas I was looking for. On one of our group Skype video chats, me in my apartment, Carly at home in Exurbia, and Jeff streaming in from Costa Rica, where he was teaching meditation as part of some boondoggle, the details of which remain opaque to me, I told Jeff that I was using meditation to boost my creativity, and he lit up with excitement and encouragement. He called the discomfort that often accompanies an apparently uncrackable obstacle, quote, the bloom of unknowing, and said that learning how to relax into the agony of uncertainty could be carried over to so many aspects of our lives, from career to health to parenting, where circumstances are out of our control. Watching his beaming face on my computer, I thought about the Buddhist term mudita, which means sympathetic joy. I describe it as the opposite of Schadenfreude. Jeff is a mudita samurai. The good vibes did not last, though. After about a month and a half of maintaining an insane work tempo, the sheer wear and tear started to catch up with me. Having to write a chapter a week on top of a day job and a family was an immense strain. I was falling asleep on the couch every night with pages from various chapters in my hand, which would lead inexorably into macabre stress nightmares. Meanwhile, I had entered a particularly hectic stretch at ABC News and was finding less and less time to rest or hang out with Bianca and Alexander. I was withering. Jeff was not helping. Under many conditions, say, sitting on a bus driving across the country, Jeff's idiosyncrasies, such as his penchant for lofty notions, labyrinthine reasoning, and wildly enthusiastic overthinking, can be endlessly charming. However, as I was laboring in the fields of composition, hobbled by stress and exhaustion, I was starting to lose my sense of humor. Things came to a head when he sent me a 17-page memo describing, often in rather abstruse terms, how he envisioned the flow of the meditation instructions through the book. If I had read it under normal circumstances, the document, which was well-crafted and deeply thoughtful, would have been fascinating. But in my diminished state, it was instead massively anxiety-producing. As my eyes washed over the seemingly endless verbiage, I was toggling between barbed wire prepuncia and defensive dissociation. It would go something like this. Jeff, the various absolute qualities or facets, i.e. things that somehow feel more fundamental, meaning peace, equanimity, intimacy. Jeff wants to turn this book into a turbid, turgid exegesis on gnosis. People are going to think his elevator doesn't go to the top floor. Jazzercise. Jeff, insight into the subtle like-don't-like layer, Vedana, which is part of grokking equanimity. Clouder of cats, colony of bats, rafter of turkeys, richness of ravens. Jeff, insight is perspective. Parliament of owls, paddling of ducks, tiding of magpies, murder of crows. We hopped in another Skype chat, and I gave Jeff a lengthy cri de coeur about how, given my limited bandwidth and diminishing inner resources, I really, really, really needed him to simplify things. I begged him to channel the version of Jeff that had shown up in Jackson Square in New Orleans and was able to talk to rank amateurs about basic meditation. I wanted the beery, buccaneering Jeff, not the guy who seemed like he wanted to anoint your head with oil. He reacted with characteristic, but no less impressive, empathy and lack of defensiveness, promising he understood my dilemma and wanted to help out. Just days later, though, he fired off an email with more grand editorial and pedagogical plans that ranged over grounding and containment, natural awareness, and Buddha nature. It sent waves of peevish juices sluicing through my brain. Intellectually, I knew this was not personal. Jeff was just excited about the project, and this was his way of working. Viscerally, though, I was messing with righteous Robert Johnson anger. Carly may occasionally be overtaken by the rage fairy. I temporarily become the rage ferret, a small and otherwise harmless varmint who happened to have rabies. I was so mad at Jeff that out of sheer self-destructive cussedness, I refused to do welcome to the party anymore. My comments in the marginalia started to take on a rather acidic tone. Here's a sample. For the love of God, please no more mention of the kleshas. Jeff seemed mystified and taken aback. The goodwill from the road trip was in acute danger of evaporating. My mood soured even further as we began the process of reaching out to the people we had met on the road trip to see if we had been able to help them start meditating. We had sent many of them recordings of personalized meditations from Jeff, which we hoped would provide real incentive. The initial results were decidedly mixed. 3 months after our session on day one of the road trip, I sent my co-anchors from Weekend Good Morning America an email with the subject line, Moment of Truth. Sarah Haynes replied that she had not been able to get over her consistency problem. Ron Claiborne said he never even started. Rob Marciano refused to give me a straight answer of any kind. Via text, Josh Groban said he had meditated pretty steadily for a few weeks, but then had fallen off, although he fully intended to restart at some point. One positive side note here. After having spoken candidly in our interview about his career anxieties, he had been honored with a nomination for a Tony Award. I reached out to Danielle Monaro from Elvis Duran's show, for whom we had also created a special meditation. She replied with an email that read, LOL, so I could not open the file. I kept meaning to email you and then always forgot. Sorry, is there a way to send in another format? Sorry. These responses were, to say the least, disheartening. if we couldn't even help the people we had personally met and for whom we had tailored meditations, what did this say about the thesis of our entire book? I felt like Dan Quixote. Then things started to turn around. Paula Ferris got back to say that she had meditated for a few weeks, stopped, but then started strong again and was currently doing it daily. You sold me, she wrote. She found doing the practice on a nearly everyday basis had given her the shot of equanimity she so deeply craved in her supremely busy life. Bethany Watson, also from the Elvis Duran Show, wrote to say that she was doing short sessions a few times a week, usually before bed, and it's helping me deal with stress in a much more positive way. Our friends at Virginia Military Institute had taken a minor PR hit when we posted the audio of our interview with the meditating professors on my podcast. The cadets at a rival school, the Citadel, posted the following online. First coloring books and now meditation? About time to change the name to Virginia Military Commune. But we heard from Professor Holly Jo Richardson, who said that, in fact, we have had very positive press within the VMI community after your visit. And Anthony Wilson, the cadet who was on track to join the Army Special Forces, sent an email saying that he was meditating with his roommates for 10 minutes nearly every day and also employing the RAIN technique. He said, as someone with a quicker temper and a tendency to be a grump, this structured mindfulness helps me the most in dealing with relationships and avoiding needless arguments. To my delight, we received an encouraging update from Sergeant Raj Johnson, the Tempe officer, who initially told us he feared that meditation would erode his edge. He reported that he had been meditating after workouts and also after stressful calls, which had helped both his focus and his sleep. Since our meeting, he reported, meditation was something he was growing into. Myrel Miner from the Inside Out Writers Program called to say that he too was meditating. He still had bills to pay and his car was still giving him problems, but he said meditating helped him not overdo it on the worrying. Also, he and his girlfriend recently had a baby girl. They named her Serenity. Candace Price, Myrel's friend from IOW, not only was meditating, but also had cajoled her father, who had recently gotten out of prison, into doing it with her. She said it made him more relaxed, more at ease. As for what the practice was doing for her, she said, quote, it helps me forgive and to be accepted, to be forgiven. The update I was most worried about seeking was Bianca's. After years of studiously avoiding lecturing her about meditation, I feared that merely asking her whether she was doing it would result in either spooking her or landing me in the doghouse. I seriously considered asking Carly to do it for me. I sucked it up, though, and broached the topic on my own. On a sunny weekday morning after our son had gone to preschool, we sat at the dining room table in our apartment. Ever the diligent student, she hates when I mention this, but the woman graduated at the top of her class in medical school, she pulled up a whole litany of notes she had made in a file on her phone. Just so you know, I said, hoping to minimize the pressure from the outset, I have no expectation that you did it. I only want the truth. Well, I only want to give you the truth, she replied, but I have been doing it, so I would like some credit. That provoked a big belly laugh of relief from me. I don't want to ruin your shtick as me being your anti-mascot, she said, but too bad. I was ecstatic. Not only because I had won over my toughest mark, but because I knew this practice could be incredibly useful and healing for her. Mind you, Bianca didn't give me any of the credit. She rightly praised Jeff for cleverly reframing the practice from a chore into an act of indulgence and also self-care. She was particularly moved by the meditation he made for her, in which he told her she could escape from, quote, Dan's gulag. She said, when I first listened to it, I cried because I couldn't believe somebody who didn't know me that well would put so much thought into something special for me. It was so nice that I was almost ashamed that I couldn't be that nice to myself. Every night when putting the kid to bed, she had been meditating while snuggling with Alexander as he drifted off to sleep. She would be mindful of her breath, his breath, random noises, passing emotional squalls, whatever came up. And then when she got distracted, she just started over. She described it as a fun, roll-with-it kind of experience. Additionally, she was doing the occasional body scan whenever she had a spare moment, or even just stopping to take a few deep, mindful breaths while at work or sitting on a bench in Central Park. She said she had learned two major lessons from her experiences thus far. "It's made me feel how important it is to take care of yourself in order to take care of other people, which has been 100% the opposite of my mantra my entire life. Take care of other people. Don't take care of yourself. You can do that for a time, but then inevitably it catches up to you." Also, being connected to her body, which interestingly, given that she's a physician, she said she'd never been good at, had helped her get out of her head and act less mindlessly. When anxiety or anger arose, she was allowing herself to fully experience it instead of acting impulsively. "It's not haphazard," she said, of her practice. "Doesn't mean I don't feel it, doesn't mean I don't want to go there, but I can see it very, very, very quickly." All of which had left her better equipped to manage perhaps the most challenging person in her life, her husband. "I'm very attuned to your mood. I want to make sure you're okay a lot. And when I can't tell, my go-to is, I must have done something wrong. Even though I also know you and know that's kind of just your face sometimes. But it's still a reflex for me to assume it's me." Of late, though, when she sensed that I was burning over something, quote, "either I would probe gently or I'd leave it alone. And it's very survivable and quite empowering and healthy, I hope." In fact, I had been pretty damn moody of late. Not just moody, clearly fried. It had gotten so bad that Bianca, on one particular morning, had felt compelled to take me aside for an intervention. She pointed out that I had been working literally every moment of every day since the end of the road trip. When I wasn't engaged in my day job, I was writing this book. I had taken zero downtime, no rest. Exacerbating matters, I would reward myself with sugar bonanzas a few nights a week, which only further degraded my sleep. Bianca convinced me that I needed to slow down or I was going to crash and burn. I was struck by the thunderously obvious fact that I had been neglecting my own self-care to my detriment and that of everyone around me. I had been running myself ragged, which was making me exhausted and irritable. I agreed to take more downtime and perhaps more challenging to cut out sugar, at least until the book was done. Ironically, given that I was annoyed with him, I drew yet again upon the wisdom of Jeff. To make my meditations more restful, I started doing entire sessions while lying down. By and large, they did not, as I had feared, turn into inadvertent naps, although when they did, so be it. I also began using Jeff's notion of friendliness to deal with my sugar cravings. Desire is the apex predator of my mental jungle. During my previous attempted sugar fasts, I had white-knuckled my way through my usual post-dinner bouts of howling want. "Just one cookie. Are you really going to deprive yourself? Don't be a slave to conventional dietary concerns cooked up by the food police. Why punish yourself when you know it won't last anyway?" Instead of fearing, or worse, believing the samizdat circulated by my ego, I started to welcome it the way I'd welcome my son when he wanted to wrestle. Bring it on. It was vastly more effective than anything I had previously tried. Pretty soon I started to sleep and feel better. I became more rational, less quick to anger. My comments in the margins of the Google Docs were decreasingly antagonistic. I called up Jeff and we talked it out. I explained my frustrations about the fact that I often felt like he was trying to turn a book designed for skeptics into a modern version of the Bhagavad Gita. He apologized while also pointing out that it could be rather unpleasant to be on the receiving end of my exterior Robert Johnson, for which I in turn apologized. It was a case of conflict resolution every bit as successful as our confab on the bus with Eddie and Ben. As can sometimes happen when you have a thorough airing of grievances with a friend, the result was that I felt even closer to Jeff. It also gave me a deeper understanding of the centrality of ADD to his psychology. Yes, I had heard him discuss the condition at length when we were out on the road, but during the writing process, I truly experienced it firsthand with all those compulsive digressions into deep-end meditative theory. In our call, he explained that his habit of getting carried away was a source of shame for him. He said, the honest truth here is that when I get super activated in a nerdy idea explainer way, I can lose mindfulness. I feel like a fraud when it happens. It's embarrassing. What a story, I thought. A meditation teacher with imposter syndrome. The good news is that over the course of the